Okay, today is Monday, March 14th, at 2022. Time is around 12:30 p.m. This is Patrick Callahan, Adult Services Manager at the Westchester Public Library. I'm conducting an interview for the Veterans History Project. Today I'm going to be interviewing Lawrence Valancourt, a resident of Westchester and a library patron, and also present is Ryan Flores, Technical Services Manager at Westchester Public Library. We're going to be interviewing Mr. Valancourt about his experience serving in the Vietnam War. Okay, it's good to talk with you today. Why don't we start out by talking about when and where you were born and who your parents were and what their occupations were.
Okay. I was born in Chicago on July 15th, 1945. I grew up in Chicago. I went to public schools, Julie Ward Howe and Austin High School.
Oh, okay.
And from Austin High School I graduated in 1964, and I joined the Army. And my parents, my dad, Chester L. Valancourt, was a World War I veteran, and he served 35 years in as a Chicago motorman for the CTA. And my mother was a housewife.
Okay. And your mother was Italian, is that right?
My mother was Italian and my dad was French.
Okay. And your mother had emigrated here, is that right?
No, she was born here.
Oh,
her parents immigrated here, and they had, I think, seven children.
So, okay. Six or seven. Okay, so who were your siblings, and did any of them serve?
I have three older brothers, and one served in the Air National Guard, and one served in Vietnam in the 101st Airborne, and he was in Vietnam, and that's Chester Valancourt, Jr., and my other brother didn't serve.
Okay. So what were your parents or siblings' feelings about you joining the service?
They were a little surprised, but then they were pleased and kept in touch with me quite a bit while I was in the service.
Okay. Okay, did you hold any jobs before entering the service?
No, I went right from high school into the Army.
Right, okay. So were you drafted or did you enlist?
I enlisted.
You enlisted, mm-hmm. Okay. How come? Why'd you enlist?
Well, my dad being in World War I, we talked every once in a while, and of course he didn't say a whole lot about his experiences. And I had a buddy of mine that we were talking about what we would do after high school, and we thought, well, why don't we just go into the Army? I mean, the draft was coming around, and we thought instead of getting drafted and being put into something that we didn't know anything about, we decided to enlist and try to get into a job that we would like.
Oh, okay. All right. So when you enlisted, what do you, was there anything that you felt like you left behind? Obviously, your parents, siblings. Was it difficult to be deployed and leave everything behind, or?
Well, not for me. I think it was a matter of I had a direction in life. You know, then I'm going to serve in the military, and if I get out, then I, depending what I knew how to do, I'd get a job then.
Okay.
And serve civilian life.
All right. Now, we talked about this before we were recording, and I omitted it from the introduction, but why don't you describe, which branch you entered and, you know, why did you choose that branch?
Well, I served, in high school for 4 years, and I was in the ROTC for three of them. And this buddy of mine and I, we talked about it, and we thought, well, let's go into the Army. And so we did. We decided we'd enlist in the Army.
Okay. So what type of training or schooling did you have? Obviously, this refers to your training in the Army.
Right. Well, in basic training, of course, everybody had the same experience because it was a matter of, you know, shaping you into a person that they wanted to have. And after basic training, I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana, and that's where I had what they call AIT, Advanced Individual Training. And I trained as a clerk, and once I got out of that, I was permanently assigned to Ireland Army Hospital at Fort Knox, Kentucky, in the Medical Records Division section. And from there, went to Germany. But before I went to Germany, like I said, they said it was a 3-year obligation for somebody that wasn't married, so I had only 2 years left in my service, so they discharged me and re-enlisted me at the same breath for 3 years, but it was actually an extension of one. And I went to Germany and was assigned to the Fliegerhorst Kaserne, 503rd Aviation Battalion, and I was a medical records clerk there at the dispensary for a while, and then I took on-the-job training, OJT, excuse me, and changed my MOS from a clerk to a combat field medic.
Okay. MOS, that's military occupational?
Military occupation, method of study.
Oh, method of study, okay.
Right, MOS.
Okay, what is your most vivid memory of your time in training? Does anything stand out as most vivid memory from training?
Which training are you talking about?
Your initial, I think, training, upon enlisting.
Oh, upon enlisting?
Yeah.
My basic training, I mean the initial one? Well, it was my most vivid memory is when we got off the buses, we were all, you know, green and didn't know what we were doing or where we were supposed to do it, and they told us that. I remember the first thing that we had to do was to get our shots.
Oh, okay.
Well, first of all, we got a haircut. And you sat in the chair, and the guy said, "You want your sideburns?" And I said, "Sure," and he handed it to me. And, of course, he gave you the buzz cut. And then we went from there. We went to the dispensary where there was a lineup of medics, and we just walked and stood in front of them, and they gave us shots in both arms and went down and got no more shots. And out the door we went. And another experience we had there was the gas chamber training. They had us put our gas masks on, and we went into the building, and they talked to us for a while, and now they said, "Now take your gas masks off." We took our gas masks off, and they said, "No." And some of the guys took deep breaths, thinking they can hold their breath while they're standing in there. They said, "Now repeat your name, your rank, and your service number." And by that time, your lungs were filled with the gas and tear gas, and so we went out. And some guys threw up, and some guys, you know, it was interesting.
Huh. Any particular instructor stand out in your mind?
It was an interesting, our platoon sergeant. We were housed in barracks that were made of wood. And we were told that if those things ever caught on fire, you had about a good 60 seconds to get out of there before it went up like a match. And so our drill sergeant, it was E5, I can't remember his name. But he was a young fella. He was, I think, probably in his mid to late 20s, you know, maybe early 30. And he was an interesting fella. He was overly military at times, and then sometimes he wasn't.
Mm.
And I can get back to him a little later on, but our drill sergeant was interesting. He was a black fella, and he called cadence, and you kept up. And if you didn't keep up, you dropped and gave him 10. You know. And now I look back and I see that basic training was just a way of them molding you into a military person. Take orders, follow the orders, so then you can be able, once you get through the ranks, you can be able to give them.
Okay. What was the hardest part of training?
The hardest part of basic training? I think it was the early up to rise and late, you know. So, and, of course, we had 40-pound backpack hikes that we went on. They had certain names for certain hills, and one was called Heartbreak. Agony, Heartbreak, and I can't remember the other one. But they were interesting. And the final thing I remember was that we had the final physical training that we had to pass before we could get out of basic training, and if you didn't pass, you had to redo it, was to run a mile in under 8 minutes. 8 minutes or under, in combat boots, you know, and fatigues. And I just barely made it.
I couldn't do that with running shoes on. So did you qualify with any specialized equipment?
Well, we all qualify. I qualified with an M1 rifle as a marksman. And once I became a medic, I had a .45, and I qualified sharpshooter with that.
Did you have any experience with firearms prior to that, or?
We had, in the ROTC in high school, we had a rifle range down in the basement of the school, and that's where we fired .22s.
Oh, okay. All right.
But other than that, no.
Okay.
In fact, I got what they called an M1 thumb at the rifle range. The M1 rifle, when you put a round in, the chamber is open, and once you close it, you fire it, it opens again, and it kicks out the shell. Well, mine didn't kick the shell out, so you have to take it out with your hands.
Oh.
Well, you take it out with your hands very carefully, because if you don't, you don't know when that bolt's going to come sliding forward. And I grabbed it, and it caught my thumb, it turned black and blue.
Oh, man.
I mean, that's what they call an M1 thumb.
Thumb.
So not everybody got one.
Okay, what was the easiest part of the military lifestyle for you to adapt to, and why do you think that was?
The easiest part, huh? I think once you were permanently stationed someplace where you weren't expected to be certain place, you know, early in the morning and all that stuff. You had a job. It was like a job. You were in uniform. Like when I was at Ireland Army Hospital. We got up at Reveille. We went to the mess hall. We ate. And then we went to work. Certain time, you got off work. You went back to your barracks. If there were duties to perform, you perform your duties. If not, you had your free time.
Okay. All right. Now, I know in our conversation before the interview, you'd mentioned you were E5, mm-hmm. And it looks like you had a kind of maybe atypical experience. Did you receive any promotions, or could you just tell us about your?
Well, the promotions in the military when I was in, you had to be in eight months before you could be promoted to a PFC, a private first class, and then after that, you had to be in time of grade. I think it was another 8 to 12 months before you could be considered for a next promotion, which would be an E4, a corporal or a specialist fourth class. Or no, an E4 would be a corporal or a specialist fourth class. And once you were eligible for that, there had to be a slot open for you to be able to take that particular promotion. And then you would be interviewed by a a panel of, like, a sergeant and your company commander or something like that. And there would be more than one person applying for that spot, you know. So, and then you, once you were, you're done with your interview and all that, a week or so later, you'd look on the bulletin board and see if who was promoted. You
know. Okay.
And so I got promoted to E4, and then specialist fourth class, and then in Germany, I was promoted to E5. And are you familiar with the what the rank looks like on your arm, the specialist?
I'm not. All right,
it's kind of like a diamond shaped patch with an eagle in the middle of it, and that's an E4. An E5 has a yellow stripe over the top of it, and E6 would have another one over it, and E7 would have another one, and E8 have a yellow stripe going down about at the bottom of that point, and that's just how you tell the different ranks.
Okay. All right, so now we're going to move on to wartime service.
Okay.
So, if you don't mind, where did you serve again?
I served 35 months, 35 days shy of 36 months in Germany.
Germany.
I was fortunate not to have to be sent to Vietnam. Of course, being a combat field medic, they were always in demand, but luckily I didn't have to get sent there.
What were your recollections of that? I mean, did you feel relieved at the time? How did you feel about where you served?
I was excited to be serving in Germany, you know, in another country. And where there wasn't war, you know.
Yeah.
But that was a frame of mind of, you know, I'm there to do a job and I'm representing my country because you're not always on post. You know, you get time off weekends and stuff like that. You can get a 2-day pass or a 1-day pass or an 8-hour pass to go outside and wander around the little town of Hanau and have a beer or two and stuff like that. And so that's what some of my buddies and I did. And once you got back on post, you know, there was kind of a switch in your mind saying, all right, I'm not a civilian now, I'm in the military type thing. And, you adapted to that really easily.
Did you absorb any, like, the language or any aspects of German culture at all, or...?
You spoke a little bit of German, but not much. I mean, you weren't in contact with the German people a lot.
Okay.
I do remember, you know, there was a good experience where we would go to a training with a joint unit from England. And the British troops would train alongside of us. And it was interesting talking with them and how they dealt with, you know, military service. We were at Waldflicken was the name of the town, or Grafenwehr, one of the two, and we were training with this unit, and I noticed there was one of their sergeants had a couple of guys digging a trench, and they were about up to their waist in this trench, and I said, what are they doing? They're serving their hard labor. They messed up and they're being punished. I said, okay. So what's the trench for? He said, you'll see. So he had him get out. He said, all right. He said, now fill it back in. I said, thank you very much.
Okay. What kind of friendships and camaraderie did you form while serving? And with whom? Was there any?
Yeah, there was a couple of guys I had friends with. One was Ronald E. Elliott. He's from Terre Haute, Indiana. And he was a he was stationed in our unit, and he was His job was to land helicopters and biplanes at the airstrip that was attached to our group. And once that was over, I don't know how we struck it up, because we were probably just like night and day, you know, oil and water, but we became very good friends, you know. And we'd go out drinking together, and we'd play different jokes on different people once in a while. And then there was Charles Whitehurst, a black fellow from Shreveport, Louisiana. We called him Whitey because that's, you know, Whitehurst, you know, that was just his name. You know. Instead of Charlie, it was Whitehurst. I went, hey, Whitey. And I remember one time, I worked for two flight surgeons. And one of them had adopted a German Shepherd dog, and he had them trained at the Germans would train these dogs, and they'd beat them into submission. I mean. And he said, Valancourt, he says, I'm going to take a weekend pass. Would you watch my dog for me? I said, sure, and I love dogs. And he says, the only thing is he doesn't like Germans. I said, okay. So this other buddy of mine, Leroy Brown, from Pottstown, PA, if he was 5'6", he was tall, you know. And he was built like a brick shit house, you know. I mean, he didn't want to mess with Brownie. And so he says, where are you going, Val? And I said, I'm going to the dispensary to get the dog so I can take care of Dr. Ferris's dog. He said, okay, you want to come with? Yeah. So and he had him tied up outside the dispensary by the railing of the stairs. And as soon as Brownie started walking up, that dog lunged at him. I said, Brown, you German? He said, yeah. He said, just get back. And I had the dog in the dispensary on Friday, Saturday night, and it got too cold in there for me to stay in there, you know, because I turned the heat off and it was in the wintertime. And then I said, I'll take him to the barracks. I'll tie him to the bottom end of my bed, and it'll be fine. Whitey was on CQ, or charged quarters that night, and he had to do bed checks every night. You know, you open the door and you shine the light in, see if everybody's in their bed. I got my dog on the end of the bed, and Whitey opens the door and shines the light in, and all he saw were these teeth coming at him, because whatever that dog was attached to, he protected, and he was protecting me, and all I saw was Whitey's flashlight and his hat suspended in midair, and he was gone. He was out of there, and he saw me the next morning. He says, why didn't you tell me you had a dog in there? I said, you didn't ask.
That's great.
And there was one fella, Tom Cruise, who volunteered to go to Vietnam, and I never heard from him since. Oh, we're a pretty close-knit unit.
Are these other fellows that you mentioned, are you still in touch with them?
I haven't been in touch with Ron Elliott for a long time. I went to, when I got out of service and got married, stuff like that, I drove down and met him, and it was interesting. He told me that his son, Ronald III, Ron Elliott III, joined the Army and was stationed at the same concern in Hanau that he was.
Oh, wow.
And it was a coincidence. Yeah. So I thought, wow, that's special.
So how did you keep in touch with your family when you were abroad?
My dad had this old typewriter, and I still have it. It's an old upright Underwood, you know, solid iron thing. And he'd type messages to me on postcards, and they'd mail them out to me. And I think I got one like almost every week, you know. And my mom would write a letter. And when my brother was wounded, he was wounded in Vietnam. He got shot in the butt because he was crawling on the ground, and some snipers, I guess, saw his butt going up and down and shot him. You know. He wrote me and says, I got wounded. It's in the butt, but don't tell Mom. I want to tell her when I get home.
Now, you mentioned earlier about, you know, you and some of your buddies going out and when you were off post and maybe going to have a couple drinks or anything like that. Anything else you did for recreation?
I went on a religious retreat to Berchtes Garden with another member of our unit. He spoke fluent German and he had a little Volkswagen, so we drove up to Berchtes Garden and stayed at the General Walker Hotel in Berchtes Garden, and it was three quarters of the way up the mountain, and on the top of the mountain was that Hitler's tea house that they talk about a lot. And so we went from there, we stayed at that hotel, and then when our religious retreat classes and stuff were over, we drove like into Salzburg, Austria, and we a little bit around some different places that he knew. So yeah, that was a neat experience. Then on the outside of the post, there was an American Legion post there, and we'd go over there and we'd have a drink or two there. And so, yeah.
Okay. We're going to move on in a minute just to the end of your service. But before we do that, if you could pick one thing, what would you say was the best part of your wartime service?
The best part?
Yeah.
It was all good. I mean, getting to know, I like people, and I like to get to know people, and I was in the perfect job to do it, you know. I think associating with the different races and ethnic people that were in our units and different units, that was kind of a neat thing. Yeah. Oh, and I even met Don DeFore. Remember Don DeFore? He was an actor, and he came to on our post and was at the USO Club.
And I got
some pictures of him shaking his hand, and his wife was with him. It's the only celebrity I ever met.
Okay. Now, for the end of your service, do you recall the day when it was all over, when the last day of your service?
Yeah, we had short-timers calendars that we, 30 days, and marking them down. And, I remember going to Frankfurt and getting on military air transport service, and landing in New York, where I out-processed. That's where they had signs and papers and stuff, release papers, and turn in your uniforms and stuff like that. I kept my dress uniform, and I think I have a set of fatigues. But anyway, and then my family met me at the airport, they waited for me to get out processed. And then we drove to Massachusetts to see my uncle that I'd never met, whom I have his middle name, my dad's brother. And we went from there and went back to Illinois.
Yeah. Okay. What was it like coming home in Illinois? How were you received by your family?
Although they were elated to see me, of course, and I was glad to see them. I got off the airplane, squatted down, and kissed the ground, because that's when you came off the planes and came down the stairs instead of right into the terminal. And my parents, when I went into the military, my parents sold their house in Chicago to my brother, my oldest brother, who consequently then sold it after a number of years. But anyway, they moved to Wisconsin, and just outside of Burlington, Wisconsin. And I was home for a year. My dad passed away, and he was like 74 and a half now. I stayed with my mother for another year. She lived alone up there, and she passed away when she was 76. But when I got home, I was proud to have served my country, and I was proud to wear the uniform. And I'm a 53-year member of the American Legion. And there were a lot of people that did not experience the grandiose return like maybe World War II people did right after the war was ended. And I'm sure there's people like from Desert Storm in Iraq and all that stuff that didn't get any accolades either. But I felt, well, I wasn't in combat. I don't deserve a big fanfare to coming home. But, you know, I served my country for 4 years. I was away from my home, my family, my country for 3 of the 4 years. And I was proud of the fact that I did that. And I think everybody should have that opportunity.
So, after returning, did you go back to...
Excuse me.
Oh, that's okay.
I should have turned it off.
It's all right.
Oh, it's a robocall.
Sorry.
Okay.
Did you return to school? Did you go right to work?
Yeah, after my dad passed away, I stayed with my mother until 1970, and then I moved back into Chicago, and in 1971... I went to college. I went to Rosary College, which is now Dominican University.
Yeah.
I was the 13th male student to enroll when they turned coeducational. It took me 6 months to find a restroom, a men's room, you know. But that's where I met my wife. And after that, I went to Waterloo, Ontario, Canada for my Waterloo Lutheran Seminary, where I became a Lutheran pastor. And I was a Lutheran minister from 1978 to 1996, 18 years.
Yeah, so just as a kind of, to digress a little bit, Germany's, that's kind of the birthplace of Lutheranism, right?
Martin Luther?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Must have been a special experience for you being there.
Well, I didn't have any aspirations of becoming a minister at that time.
Okay.
You know, I didn't, it was something that the pastor in my congregation in Chicago, after I got out of the service, we became close, and I would assist him at worship services from time to time, and then he said, well, Larry, he said, why don't you think about going into the ministry? And I said, okay. So I had to go to college first. I got my bachelor's in sociology and then went to Canada for seminary. There's a perfectly good one down in Chicago, but I wanted to go to another. My dad was being in the Canadian Expeditionary Forces during World War I. I thought, what the heck. And they received me. I went up there for a visit, and they received me very warmly. And so I thought, well.
Just a couple more about the end of your service.
Okay.
How do you think it affected the way you relate to other people? I know that you said that you enjoyed kind of the diversity in meeting people that were different than you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you've carried with you? How do you think it has just affected the way you relate to others?
I think when you're in the military, of course, basic training, you're in a two-flat structure where there's 40 bunks on the top floor and 40 on the bottom floor, and, you know, your bunk beds, and, you know, you're showering with guys, and you're going to the bathroom with guys, and when you become permanent at party someplace, you have a little more privacy, and you have a little more time to relate on different levels with different people. When I got to Germany and left the one place, Fliegerhorst Kaserne, and went to the other one, being the section chief, I was put in a room probably the size of this room here. There were two bunk beds, four lockers, and four foot lockers. That's for four grown-ups. Three of the guys in there were black fellows, and same rank as me. I didn't know how to relate to them, you know, because you don't know who they are, where they're from, what their idea of a white person is coming into their area. But, you know, I treated them just like I would treat anybody else, and they did the same to me. And I think how you first come across to somebody leaves an impression on them of how you're going to be treated and what you think of them. And I've always enjoyed, since then, I've always given a person the benefit of the doubt until they prove otherwise.
That's great. Now, you mentioned American Legion.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other veterans organizations you belong to? And do you attend reunions? Or
no, I don't attend reunions. That's the only veterans organization I can join, I guess, because I'm not a veteran of foreign war, VFW.
Oh.
DAV, disabled veteran, I'm not a disabled veteran, so all of those people can join the American Legion and those other groups, but if you're not wounded or a veteran of a foreign war, then you just, American Legion's been fine.
Okay, so we're coming to the end here. There's a couple more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So not just in how it relates, how your service helped you relate to other people, but just in a broader sense,
mm-hmm.
How do you think your military service or experiences affected your life? I know, like a lot of people say that we've talked to say, I did a lot of growing up, things like that.
Well, yeah, I understand. I turned 19 when I was in basic training, you know. And when I got out, I was going to be 24, 23, something like that. But I don't know. I think how you go in with it in your mind, how your mental attitude is towards being in the military. I mean, I think people that were drafted when I was entering the service, there was the draft was still in. People were being drafted for 2 years. Others were enlisting. People that were drafted were probably ones that said, well, I got to go, but I don't want to, type of thing. Some went to Canada and avoided the draft. Some became conscientious objectors, you know. Some got deference for college, you know, some stuff like that. But I think people that enlisted like I did, we went in with an open mind of saying, well, here we are, you know, take me as I am, make me into what you want me to be, you know. And I think with the training I got and the experience I had with the people helped me better relate to people on a level of respect, more respect for other people.
That's great. Can you sum up any life lessons that you maybe learned during your military experience?
I think somebody asked me one time, were you a prejudiced person when you went into the military? I mean, growing up in Chicago.
Sure.
Austin High School, when I was there, I think they just started having it be integrated. Black people were coming in, and we weren't sure who they were, or what they were like, and all. But they asked me, were you prejudiced? I said, I don't think so. And I think that's because my parents raised us to be respectful of people. And when in the military, like I said, I gave people the benefit of the doubt until they proved they were otherwise. And if I gave them respect, they gave it back to me. So that's, you know.
Okay. How has your military service impacted your feelings about war or the military in general?
Well, war is never a good thing. I mean, it's obvious that, you know, considering, look what's going on in the Ukraine right now. But say that again.
How has it impacted your feelings about, like, war or conflict and just military service in general?
Well, I think, first of all, I think every young person, 18 and older, male and female, should serve in the military for at least 2 years. I've always said that if they reinstated the draft, half of these problems with these gangs would go away, or most of it would anyway, because they'd get these people off the street, they'd get them into an environment where they're cared about, they're provided for, you get your food, you get your clothing, you get your mount, you get paid, you get medical. I mean, they don't have to worry about anything but doing a job and get the responsibility given to them that they didn't probably know anything about before, you know, while they were growing up in the streets. Some of them grew up without parents, some of them grew up with only one parent. And I think that military service would really help the youth of today. And as far as conflicts and wars go, they're heartbreaking when you look at them. I mean, if I was younger, I wished I could do more, you know.
Okay. It's interesting you say that, because there are some countries, Greece, I know, used to have a compulsory 2 years, everybody served.
Yeah, I think one of in the Netherlands, too, somewhere, yeah. Every household has a weapon. And if they're needed, they have to go through a training of once a month or once a year, whatever it goes. And in case they're ever called up, grab your gun and go. You know, it's just a matter of that's what you got to do.
Yeah, I think Israel, too.
Oh, Israel, yeah. Okay. So, as I said, this interview is going to be, your oral history is going to be a permanent artifact in the Library of Congress's American Folklife Collection. So with that in mind, what message would you like to leave for future generations who will hear this interview?
That's a heavy question to ask. I think if I could talk to young people and have them take something away, it is be proud of yourself, be proud of the country you live in, because there's no other country like this. Be proud of the fact that you have the freedoms you have, because freedom, of course, is never free. And if you have the opportunity to serve in some capacity to help humanity, do it.
All right. Okay, so in conclusion, I just want to go over a couple of things here. Uh-huh. Thank you very much for participating in this interview. This is, we haven't done one of these in a while, and that was really great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know how interesting it is.
Oh, no, this is very good. Is there anything you'd like to add that we haven't covered?
Well, I think one of the saddest experiences I had was I worked for two flight surgeons in Germany. And one time, one of them was called out to go to a helicopter crash. And to see a white sheet on the ground, what looks like a pile of charcoal, was two bodies. That has to change somebody. And it changed my feeling about life. You know, your life, it's precious, and don't waste it. You never know when it'll stop.
Wow. Okay, is there anything that you've always wanted to share about your service or veteran experience that you never have before? You don't have to.
I think the military today, if I ever would ever have to criticize something, is how they promote people. It's too fast. I mean, it took me, you know, my years in service to get to the rank I was, E5. And I've heard in the past, years ago, that people going into the military, they get PFC, then they get E4, then they get E5. You know, within like 15 or 18 months of being in the military, they're in E5, which took me almost 4 years to get there, and they're in a year and a half. That's, excuse me, that's not doing them any good. I mean, as far as working towards the promotion, I mean, you people didn't get your where you're at without starting someplace at the bottom and working your way up. And there, you know, there should be certain distances between the rungs of promotion that people have to, then I think if you have to wait for it longer, you appreciate it more.
Okay. In a general sense, what do you wish more people knew about veterans?
That it never gets old hearing thank you for your service.
Well, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
and that is something that has only started in the last few years. That when the campaign of thank a veteran, thank the military, thank the police, thank the fire, I have gotten more thank yous and handshakes and plats in the back in the last few years than I've had in my rest of my life. It's just, always never gets tired of hearing thank you. And I think I said in my interview somewhere that I didn't feel like I was deserving of going on that honor flight because there were people that served in combat zones and war zones deserved on that, be on that flight. And I mean, I served. I committed 4 years of my life away from home, family, and country for my country. But that's what I felt was my obligation, my duty to do to do that. And I almost felt like I was not deserving of that high honor. That flight was a high honor for me.
Yeah. I was going to conclude, I have it right here, mm-hmm. but I was going to conclude by mentioning that you were, what was it, in September?
September 16th, right.
September 16th, 2021.
Right.
Mr. Valancourt was honored by being included on the honor flight.
Right.
Through Honor Flight Chicago.
Flight number 97.
Flight number 97.
97th flight, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and that flight was unbelievable from being dropped off at Midway Airport at 3:30 in the morning and being dropped back off at Midway at 8:30 that night. You were treated like you were the most important person around. I mean, when we got to Dulles Airport, I met my guardian that was with me the whole trip there. Walked through the lobby of the terminal of the Dulles, and there, in a lineup, was about 15 or 20 people in uniform, police, fire, military, full dress, with the flags out, and for us, for me, and getting on these buses. There were six buses. I was thinking the fifth one. I was on a window on the side, and here are these motorcycle police escorted us down the road, down the highway. They'd race ahead of us, blocked off the highway so our buses did not have to stop, and got us all the way to the, and wherever we went in Virginia, they were there. Once we left Virginia, we didn't see them, but that's okay, because then we went right into Washington, D.C., and the monument, and the World War II memorial and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was a humbling and honoring experience for me.
You deserved it. Okay, Mr. Valancourt, that wraps up all of our questions here. That was great. It's a really, really great conversation. It was an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
It's going to be a really great addition to our collection and also the Library of Congress's mm-hmm. collection. Anything else? Any closing remarks?
When you say that, it sounds like how did I warrant such an accolade that, you know, to be included in the Library of Congress and to warrant this interview and that, you know, it still is humbling to me to be able to have that brought upon me. You know, I'm just Larry Valancourt. A little overweight and a little snow on the roof and you know, I gave shots in the Army, you know. And but I am proud of the fact that my dad served in World War One, and you know, he should be in that Library of Congress, but he was in the Canadian Expeditionary Forces.
Oh.
See, he was born in Massachusetts, and when he was a young man, they were given land grants in Calgary. He went up there and got a land grant and was on a ranch, and when the war broke out, he joined the Canadian Expeditionary Forces. Mm-hmm. And he was in Sir Strathcona's Horse Brigade. Huh. And he was a blacksmith at one time. And got wounded three times. And
wow.
So And he would come home. I got to tell you this story. He had a coiled up snake on his arm, a tattoo. And ever since I was born, he had that. When I was old enough, I said, "Dad, what's that tattoo?" He said, "I got that when I was in the Army. All of the guys in my unit got that in the Army and in the service." I said, "Well, why did you guys get stupid enough to put a tattoo on your arm?" He says, "Well, in case any of us got hit by a mortar or something like that and blown up, and at least if they found the arm, they know what unit you were in." Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, but he didn't talk a lot about his experience in the trenches, but it was difficult.
Yeah. And this is Chester Valancourt.
Chester L. Valancourt.
Senior. Yeah, mm-hmm. Great.
He was born in 1894.
It's quite a biography.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you for sharing your stories with us
You're
today.
Welcome.
And... we will, when this is complete and everything, you'll be hearing from us.
Okay.
We'll give you a copy.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.